Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello and welcome to episode number 93 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. News alert, news alert. Just before we start this episode, I've got a little bit of news for you. As you're aware, we've been running this podcast for a little over 2 years. And if you're a regular podcast listener, you may have been aware that this podcast hasn't got any adverts. Most have a couple at the start, in the middle, and the end of each episode. We took the decision just over 2 years ago not to do that. As a result, the financing, recording, editing, production and promotion has all been done by one person. And all of that work and financing has started to take a strain just a little bit. So we've started a Patreon page to try and drum up a little bit of support. And you can do that at the cost of as little as £3 a month, which, well, is pretty much a cup of coffee. There's several different tiers, starting from, as I just mentioned, £3 a month just to support the podcast. There's £5 a month to become a friend of the podcast. There's a VIP where you can get insights as to up-and-coming shows for £6.50 a month. For £15 a month, you can have your own little 20-minute episode over on Patreon. For £17.50 a month, you can get 3 small canvases that have been signed by or drawn on by the guests. And for £30 a month, you can have your very own bonus episode coming out just like this one you're listening to now, which will be aired on iTunes, Spotify, Google, everywhere. So please, if you're able, shoot over to Patreon and have a look. That's www.patreon, which is patreon.com/Ministry of Arts. So as I say, for the price of one cup of coffee per month, you can help these great conversations stay ad-free whilst helping the Ministry of Arts develop and grow. It'd be great if you could, but absolutely no problem if you can't. Either way, thanks for your time and back to this week's episode. Hello, I'm back again. You may have seen on social media that a little while ago I put a poll up asking who we should try and get on for the 100th episode. Well, you'd be glad to know that the winner of that poll has been contacted. They've agreed to be on the podcast, and we should be recording it just a couple of days after the release of this episode. Anyway, this week I'm taking you to meet Miss Margot McDade, or as you may well know her on social media, Margot in Margate. Margot has accumulated quite a following thanks to her simple yet extremely inviting and friendly portraits. For 10 years, Margot has given herself a task of painting a portrait a day, and now her work sells faster than she can make it. She sells it primarily through the craft website Etsy, but since summer 2019, they've been a huge success in Margate's Turner Contemporary. Margot's vintage-style portraits are based on no one, but appear to be based on, well, everyone and anyone, really. And her bold use of colour seems to emit a joyful sense of optimism. This really is a great conversation, so come with me into the studio of Margot McDade.
So I don't know if you've heard any of them or seen what we've got on there, but I speak to artists, from homeless artists who are using art to get off the streets to Turner Prize winners, you know, and everyone. Amazing. I do have seven questions that I ask each artist.
Okay.
So if I'll ask you the first one, it is, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
I would safely say it's a little bit of folk art. So everything's made at home. Everything's made by me. Actually, just recently, I did get like a professional artist studio, and I've been painting in that. So there's been a transformation in that. But I would safely say I draw a lot of faces, a lot of people. And I do love people. I love everybody. But I particularly draw quite a lot of females. And I think it's something my mum always said. She said, youth is beauty. And so all my faces are like pictures of perfect shaped faces, and they're just fun. They're not serious. They're not, I don't personally question it too much. I just produce and make, and I love painting. And for me, it really was escape. And I'd started painting just as the war in Syria was kicking off really badly, about 2010. And I couldn't watch the news. I couldn't watch. And I started painting to escape from, you know, at that time in the evening, my kids would go to bed and I'd be sitting and I'd just sort of really small sketchbook drawings, paintings away from the news, because the world is so horrendous. So
at that point, we were just getting bombarded with negativity, wasn't we?
Yeah. But also that, you know, I every year on my children's birthday, I always give £100 to UNICEF. And I think I can't. Watching the news is never going to make what's happening, you know, to watch children being bombed, to watch that on TV. What are you doing? Trying to desensitize us? What is the point of that?
Yeah.
I can't watch it. It was just, I was so depressed that was what was going to push me right over the edge, watching that kind of stuff. And so I just turned to like sketchbooks, painting, drawing, really simple stuff, whatever came into my head. Whatever was in my heart just came out. And so that's how it started.
So it was sort of like a little bit of art therapy just for yourself to bring a bit of sunshine back in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a teacher for 20 years in King's Cross. I worked in King's Cross for 7 years as a primary school teacher.
Mm.
After I left art college, I trained as a teacher because I really needed to earn money and work. So I thought I'll be a supply teacher. And I trained as a teacher. But one of my children in my class was murdered with her mum.
Oh, wow.
And that had a massive impact on me. And it makes you really, really wake up and think, you know, God, this is serious. That life is very serious.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons I couldn't watch what was happening in Syria was because I was still quite traumatized by knowing somebody really, really close who was murdered with her mum in a domestic violence. And I think it was that my art is still therapy, and it will be therapy for a very long time, because, you know, we live in such a brutal world right now. And, you know, I've got two young kids and I look at them and I think, how on earth are you going to cope, you know, with the reality of what happens in the world, what happens to people? So you need to have coping mechanisms. For me, it's art. Whatever you need in life to cope, we need to be doing it and getting on with it.
Well, that fun and happiness that you're sort of searching when you're making your art, it definitely does emit from your art, doesn't it?
It does,
for other people.
Yeah, you know, I did my very first show in Margate about 4 years ago, and I'd put up all my pictures, and I had one frame left, and I use quite a lot of vintage frames, just stuff I find in charity shops because I couldn't afford framing. So I framed everything myself from these really beautiful, usually made in boots, you know, England, 1960, 1970 boots, made very good frames. And I just did this last piece, and it just said, be kind. And I kind of, it was a message to people who came to the show, please don't slate me and destroy me, you know, it was a real sort of, it took me 10 minutes to do the painting.
Yeah.
And it was the simplest piece. Now that I did it then as a print, and I've sold thousands. So that sort of be kind, I think, was a purely accidental, just last minute thought, but it was genuine. And people said to me, oh, you know, how come, you know, you've got on so well on Instagram? And I think I went to this meeting with lots of Instagrammers, and they were really big Instagrammers, like D Campling. Do you know D Campling? Lisa Dawson. They said, what you are is you're authentic. So I think, you know, in a way, if an artist is being authentic to who they are, it is more convincing. It is more.
You can never go wrong if you're being honest, can you?
You have to be honest.
You can be criticised, but you can never be wrong if you're honest.
No. And people can disagree with you, but you're still being.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, if you look at how our governments are running this country, honesty is one of the rarest things. You know, we don't live in a very honest society. You know, just even booking an airplane ticket, it's dishonest because they add stuff. Do you have to deselect what you don't want rather than select what you do want? You know, it's become part of our culture to be dishonest. And
I agree there, because when you do see someone, or when you come across someone that is being honest, you start to judge them whether they're, you know, there's anything underlying there.
Are they legit?
It's awful, isn't it?
Could it be true? Yeah. It's, you know, I think culturally we need to be reset, you know. Yeah.
I mean, that's my, definitely my standpoint is my honesty. Only because, I don't know if you know my background, but I got into art via prison.
Yeah.
So coming into the art world, I've got a little chip on my shoulder. That people will think I'm dishonest because on paper I am, you know, although I'm not that person anymore.
But also the stereotypes.
Exactly. And to be fair, Margot, I've not encountered much of it in the art world.
Yeah.
I've encountered a minute little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And I accept that because they're entitled to that opinion.
A little bit anybody can handle, can't they?
It's of course. Just,
But
yeah, I'm honest because of that, because I want to be extra honest to show that I'm not, you know, not that person anymore. And within the art world, it's fine. You know, I've seen great things happen in the art world.
Yeah.
You mentioned that just before we started this recording that you lived in Northwest Ireland.
Yeah.
You just mentioned King's Cross and then Margate. So you've got a little triangle going on there.
Well, I left Ireland when I was 19. I spent 4 years in New York.
Oh, well.
And I think really, so I was working, when people say, what were you doing in New York? And I said, I was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar, which I kind of was. But I was working in Italian restaurants and Irish restaurants. But I worked in a little Italian restaurant in Midtown Manhattan on 45th on 10th Avenue. And it was just, you can imagine, I'd never been on an airplane before. Yeah. I'd lived, you know, in this border town, born 1969, so grew up with the Troubles and everything. Then just left at the age of 19, just thought, get me anywhere out of here. Give me something else other than daily news. And I worked in a little Italian restaurant where this guy used to come in every lunchtime, and I used to just sort of serve him whatever. I thought he was really interesting looking because he wore like a green jacket and red trousers and a blue top, and you had like orange shoes and a yellow tie. He was really colorful and really, he looked like a clown. And then we had a new bartender, and she said, do you not know who that is? And I said, no. She said, "That's Mark Gustavi, the artist." Wow. And I said, "No idea who that is."
Yeah.
But he had taken over the factory from Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
And then I knew who he was. I was like, "Oh, hello, Gustavi. How are you?" And he was saying, "Oh, who, you know?" So we had a really good rapport because I knew him before I knew he was an artist.
Yeah.
And then he was like, I would say, "Oh yeah, I've always done art, and I'd done an A level in art." And he was saying, "Yeah, you should do it. You know, you should just come and see the factory. Come and I'll show you around." And I'm like, "No, you know, my mother said never trust anybody." Worst decision of my life was like not seeing the factory by the artist. But he was a really genuinely nice person who was really down to earth, and you know, we'd have a little chat. And then I left after 4 years in New York. I went to Ireland, too quiet, couldn't cope, went to London. And that Abby was the first person I met in London.
Excellent.
Yeah. So we went to art college.
Abigail Fallis.
Abigail Fallis. We went to art college together. So we've known each other for 30 years. It's just lovely. She's a great person, great artist, and a genuine artist, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
That's what's so beautiful about it. It's like, it's in your heart, art, you know. It's not something.
And once it's there, it doesn't really leave, does it?
Once you unleash it, you can't put that stuff back in again.
Well, I got into art, as we just said, in jail. Then I'd done my degree when I come out.
Yeah.
And then I started a master's.
Yeah.
But my partner became pregnant. We couldn't afford both.
Yeah.
So I had to stop the master's.
Yeah.
And I took a bit of an immature approach to not doing art, because I sort of threw a little tantrum that if I couldn't have it, you know, if I couldn't do it, then I didn't even read about art. You know, if something came on the telly, I'd turn it over, and likewise in a paper.
You blocked it all out.
Because I couldn't do, and I couldn't handle it emotionally. And, and I say to people that it did feel like when I was a youngster and I got sort of dumped by a girl, you know, that little knot you get inside. I had that for years. Mm-hmm. And
how long did it take for that to be rectified?
It was years. It was 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And then just by chance, my friend worked in a school just near King's Cross. Yeah, he was working there, and him and some colleagues had tickets for the Foundling Museum for a talk with Tracy Emin.
Oh, my God, that museum is utterly
beautiful, isn't it? And someone pulled out, and he asked me if I wanted to go, and it turned out to be Tracy Emin was giving a talk. And I knew Tracy from when I was in jail. She wrote to me, and I knew her from when I was at uni and that. I bumped into Tracy. She asked how I was doing. I told her this noble story about I've given up art for my family, and she properly gave me a bollocking, Margot.
Good. She is a genuine person.
Yeah.
I mean, I think her relationship to art, I remember seeing her at the Turner nominations, so Turner, you know, at the South Bank, I don't know what year that was. It was Tate Britain. And her video of, you know, all the boys standing around her. She was at the disco dancing championship.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're chanting slag,
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 yeah.
slag. And I just thought, that is art.
Yeah.
That is art. If you can turn that experience, because it is about that emotion, that is modern day art. She's one of my favorite artists. I love her journey and what she's done, you know. And I think she should be very, very proud of herself, because she has inspired thousands thousands of people.
And talking of honesty, she's the master of it, right?
She is, yeah,
definitely. When did you have your first interest in art, Margot?
I remember being at primary school, and I had done a painting on an easel, and I must have been 7. And the teacher had said, "Everybody, come and have a look at this. This is really, really good." And I remember just thinking, "Wow, I love."
Your spine was straightening, and your chest was coming out. Yeah.
No, I am alive. Yeah. I've just woke up, and it was a painting of a clown. And everybody just went,
Yeah,
and it just, that was it. And then I think when I was about 10 or 11, somebody walked into class and said, "We need to make a poster. Is anybody in here good at art?" And everybody said, Margot's really good at art. And
excellent.
I was shocked, thinking, really me? And so, but I always painted. I remember I got a massive watercolor really cheap, like, but that had like 100 colors of watercolors, and I loved it so much. I never used it. I loved it that much. I didn't want to touch it. I think so. I was always drawn. And then my mum just sent me some pictures that I had, a little sketchbook from when I was a kid, and she sent it to me, and I looked at it, and I don't remember ever being that good, but they were really, really good, like copies of Mickey Mouse and
yeah.
You know, really simple drawings. But and
well, that was my first injection into the art world, was the same thing. Someone had showed me how to draw, and then I was doing envelopes and letterheads for people while I was in jail, and that was Mickey Mouse and Goofy and stuff like that. I'd done one on the envelope, and then like one on a piece of paper, I charged like a £2 phone card or sort of half ounce of tobacco for that, you know. So that was me.
But you know how the families would have read that letter with this beautiful illustration on the top of it, you know, that the art changed people's communication, even, you know. It shows love, doesn't it? That definitely. Somebody would pay a £2 phone card to get somebody to illustrate a little letter. That's beautiful.
And bearing in mind, Margot, that our wages was like £5.20 or something. So it's, you know,
oh my God, that's
pretty much 40% of their wages, you know.
That is just, I mean, what always amazes me is the capacity that we have for love. Is never on the news. I've got a really sensitive 12-year-old boy who's really, really bright and aware of the world. And he's saying, why do they never put on how good people are?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's true that, you know, it's just, it's so true. You know, we need to always look for the good in people. And even people in prison, you know, having these beautifully illustrated, that's just love, you know?
Yeah, definitely. How did you end up to be in Margate?
I'm actually in Ramsgate. But Margot in Ramsgate just doesn't have a ring to it. Well, really doesn't. So I think I did the opposite of you. I got pregnant and then we were living in a one bed. I was a teacher, and that stage I was moved up to Tottenham and was working right on the corner of where the riots in Tottenham started.
So
I was in a big school there teaching, and I got pregnant, and then we got married, and we were in a one bedroom flat. And then we went on and had our second child. I still kept working one day a week or 2 days a week teaching. And then it just got to the point where we're in Islington and a one bedroom flat, a really, really, really small flat.
Yeah.
And we were looked, oh, somebody was at our wedding. We'd heard that she'd moved to Ramsgate, which was, and I'd never heard of the place. And it said, it's really, really cheap and they've got massive houses. And I thought,
the beautiful
that's it.
Houses down there.
Yeah, oh my God. More listed buildings than Bath in Ramsgate. So we jumped, and the high-speed train was just being built at that stage. So we knew about the high-speed train. We used to walk down around King's Cross when they were doing all that work, because there was loads of interesting engineering masterpieces going on. So we just jumped on the train, came down. I had already looked online and looked at the houses, booked a few viewings, and we bought a house for £140,000. But I mean, it was small, but and then we bought a bigger house 3 years later when we thought we absolutely do want to stay here. We love it. But yeah, it's a really interesting part of the world. It's really nice because it's untouched, you know. This, you walk past houses and you think, that hasn't been touched since like 1930.
Exactly. And
it's something really nice. At that stage, the gentrification really hadn't started. And even now, I mean, the gentrification hasn't touched the scale of poverty in this area.
Yeah.
So it's still a nice community. It's a small community.
And you got work in the Turner.
Got work in the shop, and the Turner sells really well. I think it's that thing. You know, people say to me, who are these people that you draw? And I think they're just everybody that, you know, in a way I've done the opposite of, you know, like Warhol was doing like Marilyn's and, you know, famous people. I just do, you know, they're definitely paying homage to the simplicity of silk screen printing.
Yeah.
But I'm too impatient to go through the process of painting, or, you know, of printing stuff. Just like, damn it, I'll just paint these up. So I just paint and paint and paint. And people say, oh my God, I can see myself in that painting.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant. Like, but I kind of think when I see all the really young, vibrant people that work at the Turner, all these lovely girls, and, you know, and their vintage clothes with their yellow trousers, you know, Larry shirts. I mean, that just makes my heart sing, you know.
And do you paint from memory, take photographs or?
No, I just paint from memory, just from the gut, really, from the heart. It's, you know, they're very, very simple. They're very pure. In a way, I did myself a little post-it note one day and I said, right, how can I make money out of what I do? And I was earning £120 a day as a supply teacher. And I thought, right, if I do a painting a day, you know, and I sell it for, you know, say 50 quid or 40 quid, I could do 3 paintings a day and earn the same amount as a supply teacher. Yeah. So I sort of had what it turns out to be a really good business plan on the back of an envelope. And so I just started selling. And I think that's in the Turner. So my work is, I think part of the success of what I do is the affordability. And it's like, anybody can afford to buy an original piece of art if it's
access into the art world easily.
It is, yeah. Brilliant. And also I think the kind of people, like one of the most common messages I get is like, I've never bought a piece of artwork before. Yeah. I love that. I just think, you know, I had this guy contacted me and it was DJ Plastering on Instagram. And I thought, that can't be him. That's his girlfriend. That's his girlfriend who's using his account. So this guy turned up and he was DJ Plastering. And I said, are you the plasterer? And he says, yes. And I said, that's bloody brilliant. You know, I sell to plasterers.
Excellent.
And he said, every house I go into, Margate's got your artwork. I just really wanted one. I just thought that, you know, we're looking for equality. We've got to make stuff affordable.
Yeah. I totally agree. But I love that when people who are non-arty come into the art world.
Yeah.
I can't, I mean, that was me, you know. I shouldn't be in this world, really, you know, for what I am.
Me as well. Like my dad was a car mechanic. My mother's a cleaner, you know. And that's what I love about Abby. We were probably, and we do talk, and we say, we're probably the last generation of working class people to go through art school. Yeah. Funded by the government, because we, in my final year, I think I had to get, they were still giving out grants, but they'd reduced it by 10% every year.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were the last generation who had that possibility. You know, do I want my children coming out of art college with £30,000-£50,000 worth of debt? That's really frightening to working class people like us, you know, to put yourself in that much debt. We don't do that, you know. I don't have a credit card. I've never been in debt. My parents have never been in debt. Culturally, that's going to be really, really hard for me to say, yeah, that's a great investment. Yeah. You go there and get yourself into £70,000 worth of debt or 30 or 20, whatever it is. So I think, you know, we need to, I don't know what the solution is for that one, but.
I do tell people that a university debt isn't like a normal debt.
No, it's not.
Because you're never going to have anyone banging on your door.
Yeah.
For it. It's an increased tax code.
Yeah, so, it is. You do have to accept it. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just one of those things. It's
Margot, what piece that you've created has got the strongest emotional connection?
You know, one of the very, very first pieces I did in that very first show was an original little painting, and I just moved paint around in the simplest way, and she was just a blob of pink with like yellow hair, and she had a really downturned smile, and she was called Sad Girl. Sad Girl, and I posted it on Instagram, and she'd sold, and I said, Sad Girl's sold today. She's going to go to her new home. And she ain't going to be happy there either.
Excellent.
I think in a way, you know, I think I've always been sort of, oh God, you know, the world is, you know, just always consumed by my own anxieties that no amount of builders, road diggers, cheer up, love. And I think I am that sad girl walking past going, cheer up, love. And I think I always think of her. And the people who bought her said, yeah, she's in the hallway. I don't know them, but I bumped into them once and they said, oh, we bought Sad Girl from you. And I was like, oh, is she getting on? Yeah, still miserable.
Yeah.
That's good. But I think it's sort of, there's an element of honesty in that, being sad, but also it's hilarious, you know.
Well, I've always thought that, you know, when you're smiling, it spreads happiness.
It does.
And when you've got a frown, or not frown, when you're looking sad,
yeah,
that spreads empathy, because people want to sort of, we don't like that frown, so we want to try and understand it, or turn it into a smile.
Well, I suppose,
if you like,
after working with kids for 20 years, kids are so honest, you know. Yeah. if they're genuinely down in the mouth, yeah, in the mouth. It's like, what's wrong, you need to tell me. And it, you know, going back to that little girl who I worked with, you know, I was the person who put her on the child protection register, because I'd spotted that things were not right with her. And, you know, she was a vulnerable kid.
Oh, you was that close to her? Wow.
Yeah, I was really close to her. Wow. I was her class teacher. Every single day she would say to me, I wish you were my mum. And every single day I said to her, I wish I had a daughter just like you. She was beautiful. She was vulnerable.
Yeah.
And, you know, that going back to that empathy of when we show our emotions, when we show our honest emotions, then we can really get help, and we can help each other, and we can be a community. We can start being real. And, you know, if you go back to like what life was like, say, in the 1950s and 40s, and people really connected to each other and really helped each other, and, you know, we still need that, you know. And art reflects,
well, we had a bit of where that we're at. We experienced a little bit of that at the start of lockdown. Or I did, you know. I mean, I live on an estate in Essex, East London border, like Romford. And during lockdown, you know, we don't know a lot of our neighbours around here. But during lockdown, we started seeing the neighbour across the road saying hi. Because because we're stripped of that bit of interaction, you sort of, you know, we're animals, aren't we? You know,
yes,
at the end
are.
Of the day, pack animals, if you like. And, and you know, we need that bit of association with other people, you know.
We do, absolutely. Absolutely, we need that connection. We need to feel understood.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we all understood that we were all feeling scared and vulnerable at that very beginning of. And I think we're still there. We're still scared. We're still vulnerable.
I think we've just got used to it, haven't we?
Mm.
Yeah, that's the thing. We've got sort of used to it, and now we're sort of I don't know. We're not respecting it, I don't think, at the moment, and it's going to come back and bite us.
It's definitely going to come back.
But
and bite
I think that's a conversation we could steer clear of, really.
Absolutely, God knows.
The Art Car Boot Fair.
I did the one in Margate. That was my first one. Then I did a Christmas one. And then I've done the viral one. I think I've done three.
How's your viral experience? Because I know it sort of fell on its arse the first time, and it didn't.
It's been really, well, you know, I kind of think you've got to be it to some degree. I thought, anyway, art should be difficult to buy. Certainly. It added another dimension to, like, jumping through another hoop. I mean, it's fine.
It's my favourite art thing of the year. I've got two favourites, and that's one of them. I absolutely love it.
The buzz of that real life big event
is,
I mean, you could, if you could bottle that.
Exactly, it's fun.
You know, I would drink that every day if I could. That would be my morning cocktail. You know, the energy of all those creative people, and also people really love to find something, you know.
Yeah.
To find something that they can take home and live with and appreciate. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, again, the whole idea of it being a car boot fair is that it's affordable. And that affordability, you know, you let people like me into a world that, you know, the only piece of art I ever bought was a Peter Blake print, which I bought from an art gallery that opened up in Ramsgate called the Updown Gallery. It's now closed. And I thought, I really want to show support. And I bought a massive Peter Blake print. And I'd never bought anything like that before. You know, that was my proper and one and only ever investment piece, but it wasn't really for investment. It's a really beautiful aquarium, one of his aquarium pieces. But yeah, the car boot fair—it's a great—they're great events.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I wasn't a part of the viral one, only because I wasn't about that day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd spoke to Karen on the run up to it, or just when she was sorting it out before it was before anyone even knew it was going to be a viral thing.
Yeah.
I was chatting to Karen about it, and it must have been so hard to put together. And
I think, again, another victim of COVID, you know, in the sense that it only happened because we can't meet in real life, and that's hard, isn't it? But I think, you know, I've sold quite a lot, so it seemed to do well, so that's excellent. That's good.
What do you do to relax, Margot?
Pinned.
Excellent.
I do. I've got two boys, aged just about to turn 13, and the other one's 10. And we live by the sea. We're always on the beach. We're always swimming in the summertime, and then we're always out for walks and stuff. It's easy to relax around here, you know. It's not. Yeah, I paint. That's how I genuinely relax. I'll sit down now, like watching art programs or watching. The boys have just got into Sherlock. Watch a bit of TV.
Excellent.
Nothing too complicated.
Yeah,
I like doing a bit of Pilates. Don't overdo it. Don't overdo the Pilates.
Yeah. How about if there was you and five other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Oh, to show with as artists?
Yeah,
I tell you who I absolutely love. Elizabeth Frink. Do you know her?
Those
big goggle heads. I love her. Love Tracy. I'd love to see, you know, is this to show with and to chat with? Could I chat to them and see
you
them?
You can do whatever you like. It's your imaginary private view.
Yeah. There was a street artist as well called Margaret, all women, I think, because I think the whole idea of, you know, how women produce art and how men produce art might well be a different process. But I find women artists like Margaret Gilgallen was, she started off as a street artist in San Francisco. She died of breast cancer.
Oh, yeah.
She died quite young, but she was really amazing. Beautiful little illustrations, and she did sprayed on the side of the San Francisco trains and stuff. But I love the gentleness of it. Yeah, I love Elizabeth Frink. Rebecca Horn.
Nice, yeah.
You know, just really big, strong statement. Love her art
Abby
so
Pitcher.
Much. Abby, yeah. Yes. Rebecca Horn and Barbara Kruger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Barbara Kruger. She did. I love her work. And Cindy Sherman, all of those sort of like, you know, those women with black eyes that Cindy Sherman did. Yeah. Do you know Cindy Sherman, the photographer?
She wrote to me while I was in jail.
Oh, my God. Did she?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool.
I just love. I suppose really I love the idea that we I want to relate to art. I want to help it soothe my soul and connect to the sort of, you know, the therapeutic idea of being understood and seeing Cindy Sherman's photographs of, you know, battered people and broken people, and I'm definitely always going to be trying to talk to the underdog, you know, the sort of
definitely. Or
more vulnerable people in society, you know.
Yeah.
I'm never going to ever want to have a Chanel handbag. I'm never going to want to have those things, but I just think I don't need them.
Yeah.
You know, everything I get, you know, is from my art and my kids and my family. I'm not materialistic at all. I don't want things. I just love that, you know, Cindy Sherman, she's looking and what is she telling us? You know, we're all vulnerable.
Her work definitely makes you stop.
Oh, God.
Think, doesn't it? It stops you in your tracks.
Yeah, her work is sad, isn't it? Also sad, but triumphant in the sense that, you know, we're all human, but we're still just getting along. And
yeah. I mean, you mentioned there about the underdog. Do you go to the Turner Contemporary a lot?
I do go to the shows that they put on there.
The Kersler show that was there, the show by prisoners a year ago?
No, I didn't. I missed that one. When was that one?
I've been part, I think it was either Summer Just Gone, but sorry, not Summer.
Yeah, the one before that.
Yeah, 19. It was either 19 or 18. It may have been 18, because I've always been associated, or I've always worked in like the shadow of Kersler when I've gone into prisons. You know, I've been a sort of associate in some respect. But they invited me onto the board. Last year, and I wasn't able to get down there, but they put on a show of prisoners' work.
I think I did see it. It was in it wasn't in the main show. It was in the one of the wee side rooms, wasn't it?
I wasn't able to get down there. I think I did see it.
Yeah.
But what they'd done something that I wasn't aware of until I went to the board meeting. But they brought prisoners from prison. Some people who was involved in the show. Yeah. But when the gallery was closed, they brought the prisoners in so that they could see their work in situ. Yeah. Yeah. And they were saying that, like, when one of them went there, and, you know, they're turning up. These guys have never been in the gallery. They've never done art, you know.
Yeah.
They turn up at this massive gallery. They go in there. It's shut down. They go in a room, and they said one of them just started crying because he's, you know, seeing his artwork in this gallery.
Yeah. Yeah,
fucking beautiful.
That is an epiphany, isn't it?
Definitely.
But yes, I think, you know, if you believe, if you're a positive person, you've got to believe in rehabilitation. Yeah. You've got to believe that people do things for, you know, people get backed into corners, all kinds of corners. Yeah. And how, you know, there but go for the grace of God, go any of us, you know.
Well, I see that as a flag that I definitely wave, you know, because if people say it can't be done, I just say, well,
And I
don't sound like an artist or what people perceive to be an artist.
Yes. That's fantastic. And that what needs to happen is the fact that, you know, we need to break down barriers. The bourgeois elite of, you know, the 17th, 18th century, or that art was only for a very certain class of people, that's gone, you know?
Yeah, and rightly so.
Mm.
And rightly so. What would you do if you wasn't an artist, Margot?
I was working with kids, and I have to say, I absolutely loved working with kids. And actually working in King's Cross, there was one little boy he was six when he came to us, and he'd been excluded from three different schools. And he came in, he was quite thick set little kid, and you could just see that nobody would mess with him. But he was six, and like, why would the school that I worked in was called Winton. And the head teacher had got an OBE for her leadership. She was amazing.
Excellent.
And she saw good in every single child. And the energy within the school. I worked with so many amazing people. And absolutely transformative relationships with young children, believing in them. And we had one of our learning mentors was a really big black guy called Alan, anywhere he went in the school. And his heart was the biggest heart I've ever seen in anybody.
Yeah.
But he would go up to these little kids and say, "You're going to do the right thing, aren't you?" And they would go, "Yeah, yeah." But they loved him so much because he believed in them. He really believed that they were good kids.
Yeah.
You know, what the hell is wrong with our society that you exclude a six-year-old three times? Somebody's not loving that child properly.
Yeah.
The system is not loving that child. Somebody needs to... And it was the kind of school where, you know, every day was an intervention. Every day was a rescue mission. Every day was about, you just saw good in people. You saw the good and potential in children. We did a lot of art. And I think the head teacher hired me because at my interview, I was a TA, so a teacher's assistant beforehand. She said, "So why do you want to come and work in the school?" And I said, "I've got a degree in metalwork. It's really hard to apply in the real world." And she really appreciated that. Degree in metalwork, not that useful, you know, but it was very useful in the sense that I could turn a cardboard box into just about anything you could want it to be, you know, detached bungalow, you know, I could do that. So yeah, I'd probably go back into teaching again.
It is beautiful that art can change someone's outlook and attitude.
Absolutely.
And then once they change a little something in their mind,
it gives you
it's
hope.
Not long before it drip feeds down to the heart, and they're a different person, Margot.
It gives you hope. One of the best exhibitions, the one that just ended, was the We Will Walk, and it's about you know, artists through, you know, the abolition of slavery. Oh my God, in the deep south of America, they are my favorite art ever, because the unbelievable pain and injustice, and still they make beautiful art, the quilts, the sculptures, the paintings. And that's survival, you know, that is the spirit surviving no matter what. People in prison, like, you can imagine as well, that is, you've got to survive that prison experience. So art is that little light of hope.
Well, it got me, sorry to keep talking about myself.
No, I love it.
When I got into art, I didn't think I could be an artist.
Who was the first artist that you looked at and thought, I love that?
Well, I'd seen one artist called Dougie Fields, and I wrote to him and he replied. Then there was a thing on the telly about some artists that they brought the TV into us in the art room so that we could watch them. And the first one I saw was a guy called Patrick Hughes. Fell in love with him. He was the type of, he was the person that I thought all artists were.
Yeah.
White.
Well-spoken.
Well-educated, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I've fallen in love with art, but I can never be an artist. Mm. I can be a tattooer or a sign writer or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the next one was a guy called Ray Richardson, who was from Woolwich in southeast London. And I saw his artwork first, and it's very cinematic, very like 1950s, 60s. Yeah. It's got that air of menace about it.
Yeah.
And it's very cinematic. And they were showing us the artwork, and it was a circus set, like outside a circus.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, I like that. And then the bloke went, my name's Ray Richardson, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
There is people like me. Because I knew like nothing about the art world. I'd never been in a gallery. All I knew is what I'd learned for 3 months or 2 months in prison. Knew nothing about the world, the industry, anything. And I was like, and that was the spark moment. Mm. And I was like, I can do it. And like, you know, like, this is his artwork behind me. Yeah. Wow. He's done a couple of me.
Love it.
And I wrote to him, and it was like a begging letter, like, you know, a hallelujah sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it changed me pretty much overnight. And it changed me that quick that I refer to myself as a born again artist.
Yes.
Because I was I was a villain all of my life.
Yeah.
And then I discovered art, wanted to get out of villainy, found this new thing, couldn't really find a way into it. And then bang, I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And that pushed the whole of my previous life to one side.
Yeah.
And it was literally overnight. And then a domino effect after that with other artists contacting me and accepting me and inviting me into this world.
Yeah.
Just made me leave that behind. And I say that crime is like a drug, you know, like you're an addiction, because everyone I knew was into crime.
Criminal.
All of my family were, they weren't criminals, but they would all buy a bit of cheap meat when it come around, or Christmas time, to save money. So everyone would.
I lived in Walthamstow, and there was quite a lot of stuff that fell off backs of lorries.
Exactly. Some of it never even fell off. they stole the entire lorry. So all of a sudden, I'm the only one in my circle outside.
Breaking a chain,
In this, and I've broke the chain.
Yeah, but I do think, you know, being a criminal and stuff, a lot of the time, people just have turned to it because there's not been that many options to prosper, you know? And we do what we do to survive, and lots of things become habit. So we've got to establish very good habits early on.
Art is very good. I remember as a kid when it came to going to work, and a friend of mine had got himself a job just after school, and he said that he earned, I don't know, it was like £120 that week. I'm similar age than you, you. Someone said they went to work, got £120, and had to give like, I don't know, 25 of it to the government. And I was like, fuck that. I ain't giving 25. I ain't giving anything to the government.
Yeah.
And I was going, that was it then for years and years. Just that little throwaway thought that I had that day when I was immature at 16. I was like, well, fuck that. I ain't giving anyone else. I ain't going to work
my
on a building site, for instance, and then go and give them a day's wages for it.
Yeah.
And then that was it for years and years.
But I think that is criminal that you take money from them and then you have big corporations not paying a frigging penny.
Oh,
back.
When
you talk about crime, I mean, it's such a big world. And the people who are committing the biggest crimes are not in prison.
Exactly.
And they never will be in prison. No. And that is what we're really up against, you know. So that's another chapter, but we do what we do to survive, don't we?
Exactly.
And, you know, Cindy Sherman, all of those characters in her photographs, they're doing what they're doing just to survive. And I think that's what that art is, why it's so powerful, because we look at that and we think, oh well, I'm not a battered up, bruised transvestite, but I can see how she's feeling.
Yeah.
And I felt like that. I know the effect
I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there. That those hard, hard realities of life are in those people's faces.
Mm.
So
it's amazing how art can transform
your
mind. It, I mean, my partner's not into art at all. Even after all these years of me talking about it, it's not her thing.
Yeah.
And we went to Ray Richardson's studio one time. And he had this one that, on first impressions, looked a bit thuggish. It was a footballer holding behind him a Union Jack. You must have seen it.
Yeah.
How they do it.
Yeah.
And when we walked into his studio, he's gone to make us a cup of tea, and she's looking around. There's this one on the wall, and she went, "Oh, I don't like that." And I said, "We don't even know what it's about." She went, "I don't care what it's about. I don't like it because it had that negative vibe." And then when he come back in, I said, "Here, Ray, what's this one about?" And he told us a story, and Ray's not like that anyway, you know.
Yeah.
He's told us a story of what it was about, and unfortunately, I can't remember the story, but it was upbeat story.
Yeah.
And when she came out, she went, "That was beautiful, that artwork. That's two-faced cow." So you didn't bloody like it an hour ago, you know. But it just goes to show you that your first impressions in someone or something can be totally wrong until you find out the background and what's behind them.
Absolutely. You
know? And that filters right down to that guy on the street begging for for a price of a cup of tea, you know.
Yeah.
What have you got coming up, Margot? I know it's a bit of a dubious moment at the moment for the art world, but...
I'm opening a shop again. So I'm taking over a little... I do these pop-up shops where I just go in, get out all my work, put it all up on the wall, have a good look at it, sell some of it, put it all online. And, you know, my business is just... I run it as a business, so I think because I've worked in, you know, the real world for quite a long time, I like the business side of what I do, you know. I like selling work. I like making work to sell, just selling more work, really. And just, it's going really well. At the height of COVID, I was selling 200 orders a week.
Brilliant.
Down now to about 100 orders a week. Probably for Christmas, it'll go back up. I love what I do. It's just like, I'm always working. I'll go now to the painting studio and paint and wrap up all my orders for the Art Car Boot Fair. And
excellent.
It's just brilliant. It's positive. It's like, I'm earning money.
It's lovely to see.
You know, I worked as a teacher for 20 years, and that's given me such discipline. You know, I work every night. I work every weekend. And you do as a teacher, you just work.
Yeah.
But this is different. This is like building a boat waiting for the rain to come, you know.
Nice.
I don't spend my money. I keep it. And I like that, you know. I like having a degree of security
definitely
feeling like it means something.
You mentioned that you got a studio after some time. Did your work change, or your approach to your work change in any way, taking it from the home?
It literally was about 3 weeks ago. In a way, I think if I was to have it very long term, it probably would. But I don't think I actually need it. I think I work on I work literally in my bedroom on a table.
Yeah.
And Abby came to see me, and she said, the nicest thing she said was, "Oh my God, you always worked really, really hard." But literally the entire house is just covered in everything to do with my art. Every room.
Are the kids sick of it?
Everybody's totally sick of him. My husband is just like, you know. The reason I did the show, he said, "Right, you've got two options. everything goes in a skip or you sell it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, then. And he went and he had, he knew somebody and he went and had a chat with them and he came back and he said, so-and-so's got a gallery or an empty space, a shop in the old town of Margate. You know, that's your chance. And I said, all right, then. Okay. And I knew he was absolutely serious and he was right. It was
brilliant.
Stacked as high. And I was just, you know, so I was getting, you know, those canvases in the charity shop for £1.
Yeah.
I had all of those and I worked on them. So my work never, ever really cost. So then if you're not, it doesn't cost you that much money. You can make loads of it. So I'd made so much art. So yeah, I filled a gallery in my first and sold absolutely every single thing.
Well, like you said earlier, for the speed that you create your work, the price point that you put it out as, you don't need to do prints. You know, I was about to say, have you considered doing print runs of favourite ones, like the Sad Girl, for instance?
I do prints, and I think I do the prints and then I do the artwork alongside, because now what's happened, now that I've become... So I sell quite a lot of prints. I sell probably mostly prints and then 10 or 15 pieces of original piece a week. But now what's happened, I really like my original pieces and I find some of them really hard to sell, you know, because I think, oh, I like that one. Oh, I'm going to keep that one. Oh, actually, I like that one as well. Oh, so I end up, you know, doing prints off the ones I really like. And then I do sell original work, but it's just good, you know. It's just it's a work ethic, you know. I think there's a lot of work to it, but it's work that I absolutely love doing.
Excellent, brilliant. It's great to hear. Mm-hmm. I know that the ladies you paint are imaginary and some sort of snatched from snippets of life. Do you do commissions from portraits or
not really? They never work. I have tried it and it just, you don't get the same energy. You always try it because it's becomes then a sort of,
it's a different realm. It's a different world,
a different,
isn't
skill.
It?
It's completely different skill. I accidentally keep drawing one of my neighbors. one of my neighbors features heavily in it, subconscious. And people see, it's funny because people say, oh, that's your sister. And I'm like, I can see that now that you've mentioned it. Yeah. Or that's so-and-so. And I'm thinking, yeah, I can see that as well. But they're just, I think it's like that every man, they're every woman. They're just people.
Can't get those wrong, can you?
No. And it's just open. But I do think there's something, people say to me, why do you think you've been so successful? I'm like, I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. I think people like bright colours. Maybe they're bright and optimistic. Maybe it's because they're affordable. And then I think maybe it's to do with, you know, in Ireland, you had your Sacred Heart picture that looked over you in every room. You know, you had saints looking piously in, you know. And I think, oh my God, that's what I've created. It's like, I've got a holy picture for the modern age. It's like, you're lonely. Yeah. I read something about advertisement agencies will use faces to appeal to people who are lonely. Wow. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, it's maybe that's why people are buying pictures of people, is because actually maybe we're lonely.
Yeah, well. Well, every clock that's sold is sold at 10 to 2, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's a smiley face.
Yeah, they've done it the other way and it didn't work so well. But yeah, there's definitely something there.
Yeah, the strange psychology of...
How can anyone see your work online or social media?
I'm a prolific Instagrammer. So I post every day on Instagram. I started using Instagram to document what I was doing. And also, it's that thing of, I will do a painting now and I think, oh, that looks familiar. Oh, God. Oh, and I just did it again. Because if you're looking at so much art, you absorb it. But like Ed Sheeran got slated for copying something. You've got to be very careful that you're not, getting references from other people's artwork and using it in your own without knowing.
Yeah.
I like using Instagram because you can really document when you did what you did. I've got a fair amount of copycats going on with my work, which is hilarious, but not very nice. But yeah, I put it on Instagram and I've got an Etsy shop. So it's a really only because it was the simplest thing to upload to.
Yeah.
And they're global, actually. I think Etsy is one of those really weird things, which is why I think what I do is slightly folk art, because Etsy is one of those things that it's not really the art world. It's not a website, and it's not, it's something that everybody has access to and things. So Etsy's worked really well. So Instagram and Etsy is what I do. I don't have a website yet, although my sister's building me one as we speak.
Abby, your influence rubbed off on Abby because she was talking about Etsy for her bananas.
Yeah. I don't think Etsy was, but I don't know, she could do those bananas anywhere. You know, I think there's so many levels to art. I don't think there's no one shop, one size fits all with the art world. I think, you know, you can put it in a gallery, you can put it on Etsy, or you can put it on, you know, Big Cartel and places like that. But yeah, I love her bananas.
They're great, aren't they?
They're brilliant.
I love it when an artist just catches something in the moment that is throwaway to them, and all of a sudden it takes on a world of its own.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's that domesticity, you know, for women has always been like a prison cell, that, you know, you have kids and then you can't leave them, you can't go out to work, you're sort of, you know, it's always been seen as being a very negative thing. But actually, Abby made those bananas at her kitchen table, and that's what I really, really love, is that, you know, that's true creativity, isn't it? That you can make stuff at home, make it successful, and we can. And I think we're going to need a whole lot more of that in the future.
Definitely.
You're going to have big industry won't serve us. It's not serving us very well at all.
Well, that's why I asked that question earlier about, did your work change when you got yourself a studio? Because I work from home through necessity.
Yeah.
And when my partner was at home and my children were at home through lockdown, I had nowhere to work.
Yes.
He was bringing the wage in. Mine is just a little bonus, Texas, you know.
Yeah.
So I had to sort of come away from where I was working, and I ended up doing mine through the night.
Yes.
I went out one time when I'd written work to do. I couldn't do it indoors.
Yeah.
I found it hard because there was always that bit of something that needed doing around the home.
Yeah.
And I just went and sat out in the park on a nice day with the computer and doing, and I'd never done that before. And just being out of this environment and being in another, it made me so productive, which is why I was considering getting a studio or at least a small space somewhere to get me out of home, because I'm here sort of 24 hours now, you know,
I'm
dad and artist in the same day. So I find it beneficial for definite.
Yeah, I'm going to go to my studio after this. I definitely do. I'm more prolific, but I haven't finished any of the pieces. But when they're at home, because I was working on such a small scale, I had to start a piece, start another piece, then go back because I didn't have the room. Then it forced me to finish every single piece. And it forced me to sell a lot more. Yeah. So I actually made more money, and I was actually selling more work when I worked from home. Now that I've got, now my ego is all over the place, because it's just like, oh, look, I've got all this space. I can make all this art. None of them are finished and none of them are ready to sell. Yeah. So I need to be more disciplined and say, right, you've made 50 pieces. You need to finish all of them and get them sold. Whereas at home, I could only maybe say do 10 or 20 pieces.
Yeah.
And then I had to finish them and sell them before I could do the next lot. Whereas now I have sort of stockpiled way too many. way too many.
When I was in jail, I was making work for like 4.5 years in my cell. And I properly restricted in every way.
Yeah.
Then I started my degree from prison. I was coming out of prison, going into University of East London. And they was like, you can use any material, any workshop. Yeah. You can
blow your mind.
Your oyster. And with this great big studio, pick whatever bit you want. And I was like, I could be over there in front of a massive window. But that hasn't got any fucking bars on, you know.
Yes.
I could be here, be there. But there was this one little area that was all cooped up. And I went in there, I thought, I don't want that. That's where I ended up, because I felt fucking safe in there.
The
materials that I used was the materials that I brought from prison with me. I felt safe using them materials.
Wow.
I didn't want to, for pretty much the whole of the first year.
That is so interesting, isn't it?
The tutors were saying, go in the metal class, you know,
yeah.
Go in the woodwork, in the printing, yeah, just get out of that corner. And I was going, but I can't, you know, it was quite sad, really.
How long were you in prison for?
7 years.
Ooh.
I got sentenced to 14 for drugs.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and that was
how old were you when that happened?
26.
Okay. 26, you've recovered from that. You're the same age as me now.
Yeah. Well, 68 I was born, so it's a year different.
Yeah.
How long
did it take you to recover from that?
I haven't. Yeah. The prison was always, because I was always a criminal and a villain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was always an occupational hazard anyway, so I was fine with the prison.
Yeah.
It was the fact that I was set up.
Yeah, yeah. The injustice of it. And it goes back to those very primal instincts of being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you were vulnerable in that, in the sense that doing dodgy clothing, I mean, that's not, it's neither here nor there, but getting set up for that amount of drugs, it's just horrific.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because I've been in all sorts of crime. I'd stepped into it, didn't like it, stepped into that, didn't like it. The clothing thing, I thought, well, it's a way to make a good living, a good wage.
Yeah.
And it was something that if I got caught, even with a van load of it,
yeah,
the worst ways, I'd get 3 months.
Yeah.
It was a nothing. So I put myself in a position.
Yeah. It's a nice measured.
And then I have these fucking arseholes who are just greedy, don't care about anything but their wallet.
Yeah.
Put me in jail for that long and ruined my family. And
it was
because it wasn't of my doing.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that I'd always, and even now, I have proper trust issues with people.
I
don't have any friends. That sounded a bit too sad. You know, I keep my distance from people. You know, I find it hard being in big spaces where the crowds are, or gigs and pubs and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a sort of sad result.
Well, thank God you've got a family. You've got your own kids now and stuff like that. Because I think that is a massive part of recovery, really, is to have a family and to rebuild your life.
Yeah.
You know, I think having a family helps you rebuild your life. I don't think I would have my children had I not had that severe loss of that little girl. You know, that really hit me really, really hard. And it made me go, right, sort my life out. Right.
Yeah.
I need to have a family. That's it. I'm going to sort my life out. I was 35. I didn't have a boyfriend. And she died that year. And I just thought, right, I'm going to, after I'd had a massive nervous breakdown, I thought, right, I'm going to rebuild my life. So I don't think it's always, you have to rebuild your life. I think sometimes when you rebuild it, you've got to make it better than what it would have been.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't have become an artist had you not been to prison. Yeah. You made it better.
I wouldn't change it, Margo, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But isn't it beautiful that little girl has improved your life?
Massively. You know, she's still here. She's still in my heart.
Yeah,
beautiful. Still completely in my heart.
Beautiful. Well, Margo, that's all my questions asked.
Excellent. Lovely to meet you, Gary.
Oh, and you. Loved it.
Lovely to hear your story. You're a very inspiring person as well, you know.
Oh, thank
that's
you.
Just wonderful to hear to what you've done and to be part of the art community. I mean, this is the beautiful thing about the art world, like Tracy Emin or Cindy Sherman, or usually, you know, we learn so much from each other, don't we?
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, I think if the government really wanted to actually invest in people and to invest in people to think and to be articulate and to connect to people, what better investment could you make for the future of the world?
Yeah.
You know?
Brilliant. All right, Margo, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
See you later.
You take care. Lovely to meet you, Gary. Brilliant.
See you later.
Bye. Bye-bye.
There you go. A little trip down to the Kent coast to go and meet Margo McDade. How cool was that? And Margo's approach of making good artwork accessible for everyone at an affordable price really has been the key to her success. When you're finished here, if you don't know her work, go over to Instagram and have a look. Her handle is @MargoInMargate. Give her a follow, a few likes, or even drop her a message to say hi. And also, as mentioned in the intro, we've got a Patreon page to help support the podcast. And for as little as the price of a cup of coffee per month, you can help support the podcast. You can find a link in our social media bio, or you can go straight over to www.patreon.com/Ministry of Arts. It starts at £3. If you want to give more, there's plenty of other tiers. But anyway, like I say every week, wherever you listen to your podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. So, thanks again. And until next week, ta-da.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.